Last time we talked about the transfiguration in Luke chapter 9, I wanted to point out something that I probably should have pointed out last time, but I didn't. Turn in your Bibles to John chapter 6. You remember that in Luke, as we were reading through Luke, just before we had the story of Jesus taking his disciples up onto the mount of transfiguration and Moses and Elijah appearing and all that, just prior to that was the miracle of Jesus feeding the 5,000. Remember that? Where he divided up the five loaves and two fishes among 5,000 people, and they took up 12 baskets of remaining food afterwards. Well, according to John's gospel, that incident is recorded in John chapter 6. But John adds one little piece of information in verse 4. He says, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude and so forth. And then it goes on to talk about the same miracle that we see back in Luke chapter 9. So what we know then is that the incident of feeding the 5,000 occurred around the time of Passover. Now, how many Passovers has Jesus attended with his disciples at this point? I see Diane's hand. Oh. I hear mumbling, but I don't hear a clear answer. No, this will be the third Passover that Jesus. Now, it doesn't tell us anything about the Passover itself. It just says that this occurred around the time of Passover. So we don't really know much about that time. You know, how many Passovers altogether did Jesus observe with his disciples?
Three. Four.
Four. You know what's interesting, Stephen? We observed the Passover on Friday night. You were talking about the four cups of wine.
Yep.
And I was just thinking about this as well, that Jesus observe the Passover with his disciples four times as well. I mean, it may not mean anything, but it's just...
Numerologist?
No, I'm not. No, it's just an interesting coincidence, all right? Okay, so the incident with feeding the 5,000 took place around Passover. How long now, if this is the third Passover, how much time have we covered from the time Jesus was first baptized and began his ministry until this third Passover? How long of a period of time is that?
About
2.5 years, exactly. 2.5 years. All right, and his ministry lasted a total of 3.5 years, right? So there's one more Passover, and it was during the next Passover that Jesus was crucified. All right, so the story of the Mount of Transfiguration took place shortly after Passover, because it follows the sequence in Luke's gospel. What happens after Passover? What's the next event on the calendar, the God's calendar, after Passover? Okay, but that's part of the Passover. The Passover really is a week-long celebration.
Pentecost,
right? They started counting 7 weeks. You remember, 7 weeks down. And then on the 50th day, which is the day after the 7 weeks ends, after Passover, is Pentecost. Now, we talked about Pentecost a few lessons ago. What else did we say most likely occurred on Pentecost? Or it certainly occurred towards the end of that 7 week period. What was that? Does anybody remember?
Did it in Christ's time or in the past?
No, in Jesus' day, in the Gospels. Anybody remember? It was when he took his disciples up onto the mountain and gave the Sermon on the Mount. All right? That was around the time of Pentecost. And so here we go again. We're right after the Passover, the next Passover, we see Jesus took his three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, up onto the mountain, and he was transfigured before them. It seems kind of a coincidence that these up on the mountain experiences are occurring around the time of Pentecost on both of these. And now, one more question. We've dealt with this once before, but I want to point it out again. Go to Mark chapter 9 for just a moment. And it has to do with the timing of when this event took place. Mark 9, verses 1 and 2. He said to them, "Assuredly, I say to you that there are some standing here who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God present with power." Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, John, and led them up to a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His clothes became shining exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them, etc. And then Moses and Elijah appeared. Now, it says after 6 days in verse 2, right? It says he told them this. "Assuredly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God present with power." Now, after 6 days. Now, it seems to be saying after 6 days from when he said that, right? That's how it reads. When you go to Luke's account, go over to Luke chapter 9. It says, verse 27, "But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who shall not taste death till they see the kingdom of God." Now it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings that he took Peter, John, and James and went up into a mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered and his robe became white and glistening and so forth. It's the same incident, but Mark says after 6 days, Luke says after 8 days. This is a problem. In fact, this is one of those things that some people point to say that, oh, well, you know, the Bible's not completely accurate. You know, one gospel writer says one thing, another one says another thing. They immediately jump on something like that. Instead of trying to see if there is a way that both of those statements could possibly be true. Now, what do you think? Do you think both statements are true?
Yes.
Or do you think one of them's wrong?
No.
How many think both are true? Well, pretty much everybody. Oh, you're right. All right, now how can we account for that? Before we go there, is there anything that you can think of in the Old Testament that the disciples might have been reminded of when this incident occurred?
Yeah.
What? Yeah.
And so the 6 day interval would have been prophetic of the creation.
Okay, so you think they might have thought of the creation? Now, he didn't say, now remember, when he says after 6 days, that's the gospel writer's comment,
right,
saying how much time elapsed from the time he said it until they actually went up on the mountain. So that's not something Jesus actually said. I'm talking about this mountaintop experience where someone appears in majesty and in glory. Does that ring any bells with something in the Old Testament? The giving of the law, Mount Sinai, right? Now, what's fascinating about this is that the exact same thing is said with regard to that. Keep your finger here and go back to Exodus chapter 24. And let's read verses 12 through 18. Now, this is right after the Jews observed the Passover, and then God delivered them out of Egypt that very same night, right? The very next day, which is, you have to understand that the days on the Jewish calendar start at sundown, right? They start at sundown. So the day had just started at sundown. They observed the Passover, and then all the next day would be part of that same day, that same 24-hour day. So God delivered them out of Egypt that same day, and then he took them. How long did it take them to get from Egypt through the Red Sea to the foot of Mount Sinai when God gave them the law? How long did it take? 7 weeks. Because the law was given on Pentecost, which is 7 weeks after, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't given immediately when they arrived.
No, but I said, when they got there and God gave them the law. All right, it was Pentecost, because Pentecost is the anniversary of the giving of the law of Moses. All right, so it took 7 weeks to get from there to there. All right, now, after they got to the foot of Mount Sinai, this is what happened. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and commandments which I have written, that you may teach them." So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them." Then Moses went up into the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. Now look at verse 16. "Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days." Note that. "And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel." Now, doesn't that sound a lot like how Jesus appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? "Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Now, that was this day, the seventh day. All right, the glory of God came down on the mountain, and it was there for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, God told Moses to go up into the mountain. Now, throughout several chapters of Exodus prior to this, we have God talking to Moses about observing 6 days and then the Sabbath. All right, resting on the Sabbath. Back in, I believe it's chapter 16, he told them, is when he first started giving them manna from heaven, and he told them they could eat of it 6 days. On the seventh day, they couldn't gather any, and so forth. So we have that 6 days and then the Sabbath being spoken of quite a bit prior to this. And then it says that after 6 days, on the seventh day, that is on the Sabbath day, Moses went up into the cloud in the mountain to receive God's law. All right? Now, when we get to the Gospels, and we see that it says in Mark's account that after 6 days, it uses the same terminology it uses of Moses going up into the mountain. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John up into the mountain, and he was transfigured before them. So then, if that's the case, then what is that passage saying? If there's a parallel between these two accounts, then what is it saying when he says that this happened after 6 days? He's saying that it occurred on the Sabbath day. All right? It occurred on the Sabbath day after 6 days. Why then does Luke say after 8 days?
Is inclusive record included two Sabbaths?
I was going to say, is the way they, who does the timing from, is the way they look at the time, it's got something with the way one of them view the time and the other one views it like we do.
Right. Okay, Luke, here's the answer. You're right, Samari. Luke wrote it down the way we would look at time, all right? It was 8, from the time Jesus said this to his disciples, that there's some standing here who are not going to see death until they see the kingdom of God. When he said that, it was 8 days later, counting every day, it was 8 days later that he took them up into the mountain, all right? But in Mark's account and in Matthew's account, it says after 6 days. Why does it say after 6 days? Because what he was saying was, after the week, after the six-day week, he took them up into the mountain. See, if you look at the Genesis account, when it's numbering the days, it says, God did such and such, and the evening and the morning were day one, and then day two, and day three, and day four, and day five, and day six, with all the creation, and then God rested on the seventh day, right? So the Jews didn't use Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They didn't use that kind of terminology. They called the days of the week day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, Sabbath day. All right, that's how they use the terminology. So when Mark or Matthew say after 6 days, he's saying after Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, then he took them up there. You guys understand that? He's saying after 1 week had passed, that is one full week. Jesus said it on a what, Thursday? Okay, or Friday rather. He said it to them on a Friday, which would have been day six. But then, if you count every day like we would, it would have been 8 days. But if you say after a full week, because a full week is always Sunday to Saturday, see, then it would be after 6 days. That is after the 6 days of the week. All right, does that make sense? Or am I losing everybody? All right, both accounts are accurate. It's just that Mark and Matthew are telling us that it was on the Sabbath day. By saying after 6 days, they're telling us it was on the Sabbath. But Luke is simply counting how many days it was since Jesus made the statement. All right? All right, I know that's probably not a big deal, but what it does is it shows that there's clearly a parallel here between what happened with Moses and what happened with Jesus. Right? God appeared on the mountain in glory, and Moses went up into the mountain, and he was an eyewitness to God's glory. And Jesus appeared on the mountain on the very anniversary of what Moses saw, and he appeared in glory as well. All right, now I want to go to John chapter 7. Of course, we're skipping over some events. Just for brevity's sake, there's, you know, more miracles, there's more run-ins between Jesus and the leadership and so forth, similar to the ones that we've seen in the past. John chapter 7 and 8 give us an account of what took place during the Feast of Tabernacles. Let's read verses 1 and 2. After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. Now, when is the Feast of Tabernacles? Excuse me?
In the fall.
In the fall. September, October. Usually in October. All right? Now, if you remember, when God gave the law, the Jewish males were required to go up to Jerusalem how many times a year?
Three.
All right? And for what festivals were they required to go? And tabernacles. Now, what you have to understand is there are technically seven feasts that God gave in the law. However, it's sort of like a group of three that are combined together in one, and then another group of three that are kind of combined together in one. So when he told the Jews to go up to keep the Passover. The Passover was not just the meal. It starts with the meal, right? Just like we observed on Friday night. It starts with that, but it went for how many days? 7 days. And they had to eat unleavened bread only for those 7 days, right? And also during that period of 7 days, a Sunday would occur somewhere, right? And what happened on that Sunday? The first day of the week.
First fruits.
That's when they would take a portion of their barley harvest and they would bring it to the temple and they would bake a loaf of barley bread, and that was given to God as a token of the harvest that was to come. And they were not allowed to eat any of their food until that time. What is, while we're on that topic, what does the Apostle Paul liken that to in 1 Corinthians? The resurrection of Christ, what we celebrate today, right? Christ, and Jesus was actually resurrected on that day during the week of the Passover. He was resurrected on the very day that they offered the first fruits offering at the temple. All right, so when they come up three times a year, they go up for Passover, and while they're there for Passover, they stay the full week. All right, so that includes the whole week of eating unleavened bread. It includes eating the Passover meal, and it includes the first fruits. All right, then they come back at Pentecost, which was really only a one-day feast, and then they come back in the fall for the Feast of Tabernacles. But when it says for the Feast of Tabernacles, it includes the two feasts that occurred just before Tabernacles. Right? They come up for the fall, and what's the first one in the fall? Rosh Hashanah, the new year. Okay? And then 10 days later is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And then 5 days later begins the Feast of Tabernacles, which lasts for actually 8 days. All right? All right, you guys got all that in your heads, right? So you got three together in the spring, you got one in the summer, and then you got three together in the fall. All right, now when it says here in John chapter 7, verse 2, now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand, it's talking about that cluster of festivals, not just the Feast of Tabernacles. All right, just like when it refers to the Passover in Luke's, I think it's Luke's account, when it's talking about the last Passover, it shows that the terminology became synonymous. It says something to the effect of the Feast of Unleavened Bread was coming or something, which is called the Passover. So it's clear that they use the term synonymously, all right, in the Gospels. All right, so what we're talking about now is the beginning of a new year, around the time of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and the Feast of Tabernacles. So let's look and see what happens. Verse 3. His brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples may see your works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." And this is what his brothers, or Jesus' brothers, are saying to him. Verse 5. For even his brothers did not believe in him. That's pretty sad, isn't it? Now, who is he talking about? Who were his brothers? Does anybody know who Jesus' brothers were? Well, all right. Let's look at it. Matthew, keep your finger here. Matthew 13, verse 55, I believe. This is, of course, occurred earlier, but it says what the people who didn't believe in Jesus' hometown were saying. Verse 55, "Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas," or Judah, or Jude for short. Now, this is very interesting. The oldest, now Jesus was the oldest, obviously, because he was born of Mary before she came together with Joseph. But then James would have been his next, you know, younger brother. And then Jude, or Judas, is his youngest brother. Isn't that interesting? It says his brothers didn't believe on him during this time. Had his brothers seen the miracles that he was doing? Yeah, it was obvious. They still didn't even believe on him. Isn't that amazing? His own brothers. But you know what's fascinating? Two of those brothers, James and Jude, ended up writing two of the books in our New Testament. Because after his resurrection, they believed on him. The book of James was written by Jesus' brother. And the book of Jude was also written by Jesus' youngest brother. Okay? Something radical happened that changed their mind. Isn't that right? And it was the resurrection of Christ. Verse 6. So they're kind of, his brothers are kind of taunting him, saying, "Yeah, if you're really somebody, why don't you go up to Jerusalem and do some miracles in public?" But they knew that the Jews in Judea were trying to kill him. So they're kind of taunting him. Verse 6. Then Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, "He is good." Others said, "No, on the contrary, he deceives the people." Now, you may remember, as we were reading in Luke's account last time, Herod, who had killed John the Baptist, he was contemplating in his mind who this Jesus was. Is he John risen from the dead? Is he a prophet or whatever? And then we had the crowds doing the same thing. And then, of course, Jesus asked Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter acknowledged him as the Christ, the Son of God, according to Psalm chapter 2. So we see now he's in Judea at the time of the feast, and people are all wondering, you know, who is he? And there's this big controversy over Jesus. Verse 13. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up to the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? Does that remind you of something else that happened with Jesus? People are marveling at how much he knows. When he was 12, remember he went up to the temple, and the scholars were astounded at his knowledge of the scriptures. Why do you think he knew so much? That's exactly right. That's right.
You know why I love these little answers? I'm sorry.
What's that?
I was just struck by how much we all learn.
Yeah.
To have these little bits and pieces, you know, some more with the timing and editing.
Me too. All right, verse 16. Jesus answered them and said, my doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. Oh, well, he's telling them who he learned from, isn't he? Who did he learn from?
Father.
That's right, his father. If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine whether it is from God or whether I speak of my own authority. Now, this verse, actually, there's a whole sermon in this verse. Look at it again. If anyone wills, now the word wills means someone, it's something that someone has determined in their mind. It's not just a desire, it's more than a desire, it's a determination. All right? If someone determines because of a strong desire, now, where does that come from? The mind reasons, right? Thinks things through. But there's something that affects the mind beyond just simple, pure reasoning. Well, did you say the heart, Walter? The heart? Now, of course, we know that the heart's just an organ that pumps blood. But the Bible uses the heart as a metaphor for, I don't know, help me out, Stephen. What? It's more like motives, right? Motivation. See, you can take the same evidence and show it to two different people. And if that determination actually affects their lives in some way, you'll find that different people will view the evidence completely differently. All right, now, look what he says here. If anyone wills to do his will, that is God's will, if anyone has already determined, and they have a desire to do God's will, what does he say? He shall know concerning the doctrine, that is what Jesus' teachings, whether it is from God or whether I speak of my own. You see what he's saying here? The will comes before knowing. Isn't that right? But see, we think it's the opposite. We think that we'll follow God if he gives us, you know, good reason to. If he provides enough evidence, I'll believe. Like the atheist who says, you know, I don't see any evidence of God in creation. Now that's silly to us, because as David says, the heavens declare the glory of God, right? The firmament shows his handiwork. The evidence of God is everywhere you look. It's in every leaf on every tree. It's in the complexities of the human body. It's everywhere. But if you will not believe, then you will not know. You will not understand. See, you have to choose to believe first, and then the proof comes afterwards. Now, normally we think it should be the other way around. Give me the proof, and then I'll believe. Isn't that right? But see, what Jesus is getting at here is the heart. People make up their mind that they don't want to believe. And if they've already made up their mind that they don't want to believe, then no amount of proof is going to convince them. Right? Yeah.
It seems almost like it comes out of that free choice that's birthed out of prior humility. Kind of like Cain, you know, God said, if you choose to do what's right, we have to be accepted. And his heart was so full of pride that he made the choice to go the other way.
Yeah, and this is why the Bible separates the heart from the mind. All right? It's not that, you know, that kind of stuff is going on in the organ in our chest. But it uses the heart because we associate the heart with feelings, with motivations, with strong emotions, things like that, right? And so if your thinking is colored by strong emotions or strong desires, what it does, we think, okay, my mind is completely objective. No, it's not. See, your heart is causing your mind to move one way or the other. It causes a bias in your thinking. Because, now, let's take the atheist, for example. Why does an atheist not believe in God? Now, if you talk to him, he'll sound perfectly rational. But if you keep pressing him, you'll find out that he actually hates God. He hates God. Now, how can you hate somebody you don't believe exists? You know? He hates God. And so he says, I don't believe in God. I don't see any evidence for God. And so forth. But he's really angry at God. That's the problem. You see how the heart pushes the mind in one direction or another. And so when Jesus came and he began to preach this message from the Father, those people who truly were seeking after God, they embraced Christ and they embraced his teachings. Those people who were proud and who were arrogant and who thought, this Jesus guy is going to cause me to lose my position of power, right? I mean, the Bible says that it was out of envy that they delivered him up to be crucified. Is envy rational thinking? No. It's not rational thinking at all. People are thinking, you know, how is this going to affect me? How is it going to affect my status or whatever? You know, just like atheists, they want to go on living their lifestyle. They don't want to believe that there's a judgment coming. They don't want to believe that they're accountable to anybody. And it's that pride and that arrogance that causes them then to say, it causes them to be blind to all the evidence that's out there, and they will not see it. Or they'll try to explain it away, and if they have to come up with the most bizarre explanations in order to do it. That's what Jesus is talking about here. And if, in fact, that verse right there, verse 17, really sums up the entire message of the four Gospels. Because when Jesus came, this is what he was doing. He was dividing Israel into two classes of people. He was dividing them into those who truly were seeking after God, and those who had a hard heart that was lifted up with pride. And what happened? This group embraced him. That group rejected him. And we'll see that this happens throughout. In fact, John's gospel really points this out as we get further and further. It keeps talking about how he did so many signs in their presence, and yet they would not believe. Now, you know, raising somebody from the dead, healing leprosy, taking a guy who was blind from birth and healing him. I mean, how much proof do you want? Really? How much proof? But yet, they saw those things and they still tried to kill him. Why did they try to kill him? Out of envy. They wanted to maintain their positions of power, things like that. Yes, sir.
Kathy mentioned a moment ago humility and pride. And when you look at this relationship between the individual person and God and willingness to see the truth, when you have that prideful heart, you are saying to God, you need to prove to me before I'll believe you. like you're mm-hmm. saying, that's just...
Well, that's what the people were saying over and over again throughout the Gospels.
That's
yeah.
right. But when in reality, what I'm seeing here is that God is saying, you need to prove to me that you're open and you're willing to submit before I'll show you my truth.
God is saying, you need to prove to me that you're humble enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I'll show
yeah.
it to you.
That's it. You know, it's back to that same verse that we've been talking about over and over again. In fact, you guys should have memorized it by now. God, yes, it's in James chapter 4. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. That ought to be our life verse. It ought to be our church verse. Because it tells you how to get God's favor in any situation. Isn't that right? I mean, really, that verse, and it's actually originally from Proverbs. James was quoting it out of Proverbs. All right, let's move on. Verse 18. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. Now, doesn't that verse go to motives as well? Look at it. Is it talking about motives? Somebody who is trying to exalt themselves, seek their own glory, they're going to be resistant to somebody else who's going to get glory, right? They want the glory for themselves. Pride is the problem. That's why God resists the proud. All right? But Jesus is saying essentially that he's not like they are. He's contrasting them, that is the leadership of Israel, with himself. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. That's the leadership of Israel. But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. And that's what Jesus said repeatedly. I can't do any of this myself. It's my Father who's doing the works through me. All right, he said that over and over again. All right, verse 19. Did not Moses give you the law, yet none of you keep the law? Why do you seek to kill me? The people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, that is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. Now, he's convicting them based on the manner in which they were applying the principles in the law of Moses. Now, Moses said, work 6 days, rest on the Sabbath. Jesus heals a man on the Sabbath. They say, aha, you broke the law of Moses, so therefore you're condemned to death and we're going to crucify you. But there's a lot more in the law of Moses as well. And there are times when one commandment seems to conflict with another commandment. For example, he's talking about circumcision here. Now, a child, when he was born, was to be circumcised on the 8th day after birth. All right? Now, births happen randomly throughout the year and randomly throughout the weekdays. Isn't that right? So, if that's the case, would there ever be an incident where a child was born and the 8th day, let's say he was born on a Saturday, and the 8th day would be the following Saturday, the Sabbath day. But Moses said you have to circumcise him on the 8th day. But yet Moses said you can't work on the Sabbath day. You've got two laws that appear to be contradictory. But when a child was born, these very Jews had no problem in saying, this law is greater than that law. That is the law of circumcising a child. I mean, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, not a weekly thing. Therefore, it's important that we keep this law, even though in appearance it violates the Sabbath law. So they understood the concept that sometimes you have to use judgment and wisdom and understand the principles behind the law when you apply the law. All right? They understood that, and Jesus is pointing that out. Yet, what he's essentially saying is they weren't affording him the very same leniency that they did when they circumcised a child on the Sabbath day. Jesus was healing a man on the Sabbath day. See? They're not using righteous judgment. Why were they not using righteous judgment? Because they did not want to believe on him. They were looking for some reason to accuse him. And believe me, as things get darker and darker as we approach the end of the age, people are going to be looking for things to accuse us, all right, to trip us up. Weren't they always trying to trip Jesus up in his words so that they would have some reason to accuse him? Yeah. Is that righteous judgment? No. They had already determined what they wanted, and they were going to make it happen no matter what. All right. Verse 25. Now, some of them from Jerusalem said, Is this not he whom they seek to kill? But look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? I love the way Jesus does this. I mean, he gets himself into situations where he confronts the religious establishment in situations where it's public enough that they can't do anything to him. Because there's enough people in the crowd that think that he is the Christ. So the leadership, you know, they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. They want to have him crucified, but they got a mob that's going to probably rise up if they try anything. And so Jesus was very crafty in the way that he went about orchestrating these encounters, these situations. You notice he went up to the Feast of Tabernacles secretly. Right? We read that earlier in this chapter. He went up secretly because they were trying to kill him. But here we are in the middle of the feast, and he comes into the temple and starts teaching openly. And the people are wondering, what? Isn't this the guy that they've been trying to kill? And here he is teaching openly, and they won't touch him. Jesus said at another place to his disciples to be wise as serpents, but harmless as doves. It's a good thing to remember. All right, verse 27. However, we know where this... verse 26. But look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? However, we know where this man is from. Now, where do they think he was from? Nazareth. And where's Nazareth? It's up in Galilee, the northern part, right? Now, was Nazareth Jesus' hometown? Did he grow up in Nazareth? But was he born there? Where was he born? Bethlehem. And what's so special about Bethlehem?
It's where Micah said the Christ was going to come from Bethlehem.
Right. And why? Because that was David's city. See, that's where David was from. Was from Bethlehem. And when Jesus was the son of David, and this is why God orchestrated all these events so that the leaders called for a census, and he had to go back to Joseph and Mary had to go back to Bethlehem for the census, and while they were there for the census, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. That wasn't his hometown because Mary and Joseph didn't live there, but they were in Bethlehem when he was born. And that was David's hometown. He was the son of David. So that's what's causing the conflict here. All right, verse 28. Then Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple, saying, "You both know me, and you know where I am from. And I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know." Now, what's he doing here? They're saying, "We don't know where this Jesus is from." And Jesus is responding by saying, "You know who I am and you know where I'm from." Why? Did they know where he was from?
They knew his family.
Had they heard the stories about the virgin birth? Had they heard the stories from the family about, you know, what happened when they went down to Bethlehem? Had those stories circulated? We know those stories had circulated because at one time they accused him of being an illegitimate child. Now, in other words, Mary was pregnant before her and Joseph actually consummated their marriage. And so they used that to try to accuse him. So they knew the stories about him being born of the Virgin Mary. They knew all that. They just didn't believe it. And they didn't believe it because they didn't want to believe it. All right? Back to verse 28. Then Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple, saying, "You both know me, and you know where I am from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know." And who's that? The Father, right? "But I know him, for I am from him, and he sent me." You know, anybody who thinks Jesus was just a mere man, that he was just born like any other man, and he did not exist before the virgin birth, this verse and many others in the Gospel of John shows that that's wrong. Many times in the Gospel of John, he says, "I came down from heaven," or "he came from the Father," things of that nature. All right, verse 30. "Therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. And many of the people believed in him and said, 'When the Christ comes, will he do more signs than these which this man has done?'" So you can see there's this division, and the crowds are murmuring about, you know, what to do. And those who want to kill him are kind of, you know, they can't really touch him at this point. "The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him," or arrest him. "Then Jesus said to them, 'I shall be with you a little while longer, and then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and will not find me, and where I am you cannot come.' Then the Jews said among themselves, 'Where does he intend to go? We shall not find him. Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? What is this thing that he says, "You will seek me and not find me, and where I am you cannot come"?" Now, remember, he's saying this to his antagonists, to the people who are trying to kill him. He's going to go, and they won't be able to come where he is. You may remember in last week's lesson, we talked about the fact that Jesus, 6 months earlier, around the time of the Passover, started telling his disciples that he was going to be killed and rise again on the third day, right? He started telling them that around the Passover time, and now here we are 6 months later, and now he's publicly making statements along these lines. Why? Actually, several times Jesus says this. It's here, it's farther down in chapter 8. He repeats it again, that he's going away and they cannot go where he's going and so forth. What's he talking about? What? Okay. His crucifixion, his ascension to heaven. Where do we find that in the Old Testament? Where do we, what Old Testament basis do we have for this?
Psalm 110.
What'd you say?
Psalm 110.
Yeah. Let's look at that real quick. Psalms 110. If any of the psalms you need to know, I don't mean to be able to repeat it by heart, but you need to be aware of Psalm chapter 2 and Psalm chapter 110. Those are the two most important psalms for you to know what they're about. All right. "The Lord said to my Lord," now this is David. David wrote this. "The Lord said to my Lord, 'Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send a rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power. In the beauties of holiness, from the womb of the morning, you have the dew of your youth. The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He shall execute kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the nations. He shall fill the places with dead bodies. He shall execute the heads of many countries. He shall drink of the brook by the wayside. Therefore, he shall lift up the head." Now, what is this psalm about? What is the latter part of this psalm about? It's talking about executing kings and ruling. It's the same thing that Psalm 2 is about. All right, it's when the Son establishes his kingdom over the whole earth. He's going to overthrow all the nations, and his kingdom is going to reign upon the earth. But what does it say before that? The very first verse. What's going to happen before that happens? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Now, what does that imply? That there's going to be sort of like an intermission, right? Christ is going to be seated at the right hand of the Father for a while before his enemies are made his footstool, before he begins to reign. He's going to have to wait and sit at the Father's right hand, right? Now, look at verse 1 again. The Lord said to my Lord. Now, David is the king when he wrote this, all right? Who is David's master? Who is higher in the kingdom than David at this time? No, in David's kingdom. On earth. Who is greater than David in the kingdom of Israel when David wrote this psalm? Nobody. He was the top dog. All right? He was the king. But David, while he's king, he writes that the Lord, and the first Lord there is in all caps, it's Jehovah or Yahweh. All right? So Yahweh said to my Lord, which the word Lord means master. Yahweh, this is David the king. Yahweh said to my master. You get that? See, from a human perspective, there's nobody higher than David on earth at that time. Now, the only one higher than David is God, Yahweh, Jehovah, right? However, David is putting somebody in between him and the Father. Isn't that interesting? The Lord said to my Lord, or my master, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Now, that's a fascinating statement. Actually, I don't have the reference here, but it's in Matthew's gospel. Maybe somebody can find it for me quickly. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus actually quotes this psalm, and he says, if David called him Lord, that is the Messiah, Lord, how is he his son? How is the Messiah his son? And they couldn't answer.
So Matthew 22.
All right, let's read that. Matthew 22. What is it, Stephen? Matthew 22:41. Okay, good. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, what do you think about the Christ? Now, when he says the Christ, they don't believe he's the Christ. What are they actually asking him? Where does this term the Christ come from? Psalm 2, right? Psalm 2 talks about the Christ, or the Lord's Christ, the Lord's anointed, and it calls him the Son there, the Son of the Father. So he's saying, what do you think about the Christ? Or what do you think about this passage in Psalm chapter 2? Whose son is he? Now, when he's saying that, what does Psalm 2 say? All right, look, let's look at it. All right, keep your finger here. I know we seem to be dancing around, but there's a point. Go back to Psalm chapter 2. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his, in the Greek version, it's Christos, Christ, or Hebrew, it's Messiah. There. You can write that in your margin. That's what the word Messiah or Christ means. It means the anointed king. So the rulers are taking counsel against the Lord and against his Christ. Let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens will laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. He shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep pleasure. That is the kings of the earth. Isn't that what Psalm 110 said, that he's going to execute all these kings? All right. Verse 6, yet I have set my king, this is God's king, on my holy hill of Zion. That's the Christ, the Messiah. And that, now the Son speaking, I will declare the decree. The Lord, or Yahweh, or Jehovah, said to me, you are my Son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me, I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. All right, now, that's the context of it back here in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 42, when Jesus asked the question, he says, what do you think about the Christ? Because that's where the term comes from, Psalm 2. Whose son is he? And the reason he says whose son is he is because that very psalm says that the Father said to him, you are my son. All right, so it's obvious he's the son of the Father. What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? They said to him, the son of David. Now they understood the covenant that God made with David, right? He said to them, how then does David in the Spirit call him Lord or Master, saying, and now he quotes from Psalm 110, verse 1 that we read a few minutes ago. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. If David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? I love this. So, you guys get the picture? David is saying the Lord, or Jehovah, said to my master, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. David, knowing that God had promised him that one of his sons would sit upon his throne and rule over the nation of Israel forever. That was the covenant God made with David. David is calling his son that God promised him Lord. Now, does the father call his son or his grandson or his great-grandson my Lord or my master? No, that's just not done, because the father would be considered superior to the son or the ones whom he has generated. So Jesus puts this to them as a riddle. How is the Messiah David's son if David calls him his Lord? They couldn't answer. We know why. It has to do with the virgin birth and all that, right? He was also the Son of God. So therefore, he was David's master. But anyway, I think we better stop there because I've gone a little long.